And she didn't just get to the top, maybe as high as she is now, but she's been on the horizon for a long time. And Ruth, if you don't mind, I also like to call your attention to another distinguished woman in our audience, and that is none other than Evelyn Harrison. Raise your hand, please, Ms. Harrison. I want you to know, because she's been a model for me, and Ruth, I'm not taking away from you, and for you too, really. Ms. Harrison was the only GS-17 woman at the Civil Service Commission, and she helped formulate the President's Commission on the Status of Women, because I was there working for Esther Peterson during that time, and Ruth was right there, came up with President Johnson, Eleanor Roosevelt, and Lady Bird Johnson, the whole group of us. Not only did our distinguished lecturer today do that, but she also went on to the White House to become the legislative counselor, if you will, for Esther Peterson on consumer interests. So she's been working around doing a lot of good things, and so she just got a little higher at the top at this time. But she's been distinguished for a long time. And I want to give you some more information on her. She was sworn in as the general counsel of U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development and confirmed by the Senate on April 29. She served as special assistant to HUD Secretary Robert C. Wood from 1966 to 1969. Ms. Prokop has also practiced law in Washington since she graduated from George Washington University Law School in 1965. Since 1972, she was senior counsel of General Telephone and Electronics, representing various GTE companies before federal courts and administrative law commissions. She was in practice with the law firm of Brownstein, Zeidman, and Schomer from 1970 to 72. Prior to her service at HUD, she was legislative counsel, as I mentioned, for the President's Committee on Consumer Interests, legislative assistant to the President's Commission on the Status of Women, and on the staff of the Vice President of the United States from 1961 to 62. She was appointed a member of the D.C. Tax Commission in 1976. And some of her professional community activities are governor of the board of the Women's National Democratic Club, a board member of the National Committee on Household Employment. She's been active in the American Bar Association, where she was recently elected to the council Science and Technology section, and was formerly chairwoman, of the Committee on Privacy. She's a past president of the GW Law School Alumni Association of Washington. So ladies, won't you please join me in welcoming another distinguished woman in government, Ms. Ruth Prokop.
Thank you for that fine introduction. I couldn't help but be remembered as you kept going through this list of my an exchange I had with Senator Sparkman at my confirmation hearings. He's, many of you know, a fine senator, but he kept listening to this long list of activities, and I could see him. He kept looking down at me, and he finally said to me, "Are you sure you weren't violating the child labor laws at one time or the other?" And I unfortunately didn't remember I was before the United States Senate. This remark was more appropriate for a cocktail party than that, and I shot back very quickly, "Yes, no, Senator, I wasn't. I've always been of consenting age." And I did not mark that out of my confirmation hearings. However, I left it in because it's a reminder to us that nothing should be that serious. And, well, I'm delighted to be here today, and I was asked to come and discuss my role as General Counsel of HUD, and more importantly, how the decisions that I make might impact or affect American women. Now, the interest of women in the policies of HUD are reflected in two ways. First, by seeing that women are placed in responsible policymaking positions we can give them a substantial input into the major departmental decisions. Second, as we begin the very difficult task of revitalizing our cities and bringing the department back from what we perceive to be the very devastating effects of 8 years of apathy and neglect, our goal is really quite simplistic: a decent home and a suitable living environment for every American family. But implementation of that goal is not so simple. It is very complex. It involves not just passage of a housing or community development law, but also an understanding and a direction of the complexities of the mortgage and other financial markets. I couldn't stress enough, it is not enough to identify the housing needs. You've really got to understand the complexities of the delivery. Too many people have made that mistake in the past. But first, I want to discuss just a moment and address the issue of women appointees at HUD. We are very proud of our record since we've come there last spring. In addition to having an outstanding black woman, Patricia Roberts Harris, as its secretary, professional women appointed to date make up almost 50% of the appointments at the department. This figure includes two presidential appointees, including myself, five women as deputy assistant secretaries, including the deputies of both of our most important housing programs, two women regional administrators, a position never formally held by a woman. Additionally, President Carter, upon Secretary Harris's recommendation, has just nominated another woman to hold a top-level position in the department, the Flood Insurance Administrator. She will hopefully be on board following Senate confirmation. For those of you who might ask, quite appropriately, the significance of HUD to the concerns of women, let me supply you with some revealing facts. 7.5 million of this nation's households are headed by women. This figure is increasing at a rate 10 times faster than male-headed families. Moreover, females-headed families are 6 times as likely to be poor. Over 2/3 of all families in public housing projects assisted by HUD are headed by women. 2/3 of all elderly units are headed by women. As recently as just 4 years ago, the Federal National Mortgage Association, which I will speak more to in a moment, which provides the largest secondary mortgage market in the United States, advised that the wife's contribution to the family income be discounted so long as she was still in her childbearing years. Women are still finding themselves frequently discriminated against, both as renters and applicants for mortgage financing. And local agencies, which have been active in areas of racial discrimination, still ignore the problems of sex discrimination faced by women in their efforts to obtain adequate housing for themselves and for their families. Today, HUD is taking some specific steps to address issues which impact women. This action has presented itself in many forms. First, by focusing upon the provision of adequate housing to low and moderate income families, the majority of which will be headed by women. Second, by issuing regulations, which will be forthcoming shortly, to further open the mortgage market to women by prohibiting Fannie Mae from discriminating in its underwriting practices on the basis of sex or marital status. Third, carefully examining existing legislation to assure that fair housing laws adequately protect women against discrimination and to provide the mechanism so that we can effectively enforce those laws. Fourth, by concentrating upon the revitalization of our cities, where 2/3 of our women-headed households are located. And finally, addressing the concern of rapidly rising housing costs, which are extremely prohibitive to women who are now in ever-increasing numbers attempting to enter the home ownership market for the first time. Granted, many of these activities are essentially programmatic, not legal in nature, and thus require resources from across the department. Nonetheless, the role of the General Counsel in that process is vital. The Office of the General Counsel, which I head as the department's first woman General Counsel, has wide and varied duties. In order to serve the needs of my clients, the other assistant secretaries and principal staff, as well as the undersecretary and secretary, I have a staff of 121 full-time attorneys in the Washington office, with over 200 more attorneys in the field and the necessary support staff. In Washington, these attorneys are assigned to six different divisions which comprise my office, each headed by an associate general counsel, a point that will become important in a few minutes. These divisions are legislation, litigation, regulatory affairs, urban development, housing, administrative law, and finance. These divisions are further broken down into 15 branches, of which are headed by assistant general counsels. Just to mention a couple, we have a consumer protection branch, block grants, equal opportunity branch, etc. In addition to managing what is essentially a large law firm, I also undertake many other activities as general counsel. I am personal counsel to the secretary and undersecretary on major program decisions. I frequently represent the department's legal positions in meetings at the White House, the Department of Justice, and other administrative agencies. On several occasions, and I might say unfortunately in some of them, I am called upon to testify before Congress on matters of importance to the department, and particularly those that involve a legal controversy. As third in line in succession in the department, I often represent the department in the absence of the secretary and the undersecretary. Now, in addition to these duties, which are, I've just outlined, which are essentially running a law firm, I hold yet another job in this administration. I was appointed by President Carter to serve as the only female member on the board of directors of the Federal National Mortgage Association. You might not have heard of this corporation, but it is a $34 billion government-regulated corporation. This massive corporation has significant impact on your ability to obtain mortgages, and that is the corporation that only 4 years ago, or so little time is 4 years ago, was still prohibiting sole salaries during the childbearing years. Well, back to my job as general counsel. I respectfully submit that this is one of the key jobs in any agency, whether it be HUD, HEW, Department of Army. Particularly with respect to the enforcement of affirmative actions that can assure equal treatment and opportunity for all persons. For example, as general counsel, I write and enforce the department's standards of conduct. Upon my arrival at HUD, I strengthen those standards as they relate to discrimination. As rewritten, they specifically prohibit discrimination of any sort by our own employees towards persons dealing with the agency. Violation of such regulations could constitute a basis for an adverse action against any employee, including dismissal. With regard to the same standards, I made it a violation for any HUD employee in the course of their employment to attend any meeting at a discriminatory club or other organization. I am quite pleased to report that I was probably the first victim of that regulation. I personally refused to attend a board meeting being held at a club that had restrictive membership rules, with the ultimate result of when they asked why I didn't attend, we did make a change in the board policies that meetings would not be held at such clubs in the future, and I was delighted that 14 other pinstripe gentlemen asked the management to take a look at whether they should even be membership members in such clubs. In still another area, I have taken a special interest in equal employment cases where it appeared that without the special attention, the interest of complainants might not be properly addressed. Moreover, at each opportunity, I have made efforts to place women and minorities in areas of responsibility in my own office. When I arrived last March, the Office of General Counsel had only one woman in a managerial position, that of Assistant General Counsel. Well, not being above practicality, some might call it expediency, I immediately focused on a reorganization. As a result of that reorganization, I have appointed the first woman Associate General Counsel, one out of six, in my office, a female Assistant General Counsel, two female Deputy Associate General Counsels, and I intend to continue placing women in those management positions as fast as they come open. Finally, and I want to comment on this, I personally directed the preparation of an affirmative action plan for my own office. To mention but a few highlights of this affirmative action plan, it requires 19% of all attorney positions in my own office to be filled with females. This is 12% greater than the number of women graduating from law schools today, statistically. Before any field counsel can be hired, I must be satisfied that affirmative efforts have been undertaken to seek qualified women as well as minority applicants. Recruitment of new attorneys must focus on law schools, which have a high percentage of women and minority graduates. My affirmative action plan instructed all of my top staff that younger attorneys, a large percentage of whom are women and minorities, are to be included in the higher level meetings and conferences with clients and similar activities to permit them to obtain that necessary experience and to develop managerial skills. Mid-level attorneys, of which a significant and I might say increasingly proportionate number are women and minorities, will be asked to supervise team projects in order to develop essential managerial skills. My plan further instructs high-level attorneys to be responsive to equal opportunity concerns, and I left no question in the plan that they will answer to me if their actions do not reflect such responsiveness. Finally, the plan requires that support staff, our secretaries, our paralegals, who are in our instance largely minority women, be given career counseling and an opportunity to perfect those skills necessary to their upward mobility. In closing, I want to address, so that we can get to the questions, which I feel are much more important than whatever remarks I might have, but I want to address a very age-old question that at least comes my way many times, and that is, how did you make it in a man's world? Well, there was a former mayor of Ottawa, Canada, by the name of Charlotte Whitten. She made a very astute observation as to what it is like to compete against men in a discriminatory world. She said, and I quote, "Whatever women do, they must do twice as well as men to be thought half as good." But she quickly concluded, "Luckily, that is not a difficult task." It has been my experience that the first part of her observation, however, is in too many instances a truism. But I would heartily disagree with her conclusion. It is not easy. It is not easy to do the same work and get less pay. It is not easy to be equally or more competent and yet be passed over time and again for that promotion. It is not easy to see the best jobs go to the beneficiaries of discrimination while you, solely by virtue of your sex, are denied upward mobility. Unfortunately, however, Mayor Whitten's comments are still a reality for the vast majority of women. If no longer for me, certainly for the vast, vast majority. It is true that women have made great inroads. It is true that the old boy system is in bad health, But make no mistake, it is still alive and kicking. I wish I could in good faith say to you that the system has changed or that revolution is just around the corner. Such a statement would be irresponsible and in my vocabulary akin to criminal negligence. The key is to change the system every day that you go to work, to change it beyond repair. We have made tremendous strides. We're moving faster than ever. But for those of us already in those policy jobs that can make a difference, the responsibility is great. But we need the help and the support of all women if we are to leave a fair and equitable system for the younger women. As mentioned, over 15 years ago, I was privileged to work on the President's Commission on the Status of Women, which, as you know, was chaired by Eleanor Roosevelt. Need I mention that she spent much of her adult life fighting against the prejudices which have plagued this land. She was not, however, only a warrior against bigotry, but she was also a compassionate person who consoled the victims of such unfounded hatred. I want to leave with you some of her advice, because I deeply believe that the key to success over the next few years is how well we, as individuals, as women within ourselves, learn to identify and to deal with discrimination. She said, "Remember, no one can make you inferior without your consent." Thank you. This is a much more important point. I'd much rather just discuss than read speeches. So could we have any questions? Question I won't get to attempt to answer some of it. I am obviously missing in the morning some of the meetings on precisely that question, so there were some this weekend. I believe that, and I am not an expert on the reorganization plan, but I'll tell you how I feel about it and what I have been told. The attempt was to push down, as you know, and to tighten up on the managerial responsibility. Now, that means a couple of things. Let's take the first one on affirmative action in the plans.